Welcome to the Platform Podcast, where we talk to coaches, athletes, experts, and real people to learn about their approaches to training, nutrition, mindset, and much more. I'm your host, Jordan Cundy Wright, founder and head coach of the Twin Cities Kettlebell Club, and our mission is to become our best selves through sport. This episode is brought to you by the American Kettlebell Lifters Union, a 501c3 whose mission is to provide a voice to lifters across the USA. For the lifters, by the lifters. If you haven't signed up yet, click the link in the episode notes to save on our annual membership. Your membership dues support uniform costs for athletes representing the USA at the WKSF World Championships and the growth of our sport across the country. You'll receive member benefits like discounts on many brands through Expert Voice, discounts on event registration, coaching, and more. Sign up today. All right, in this episode, my guest is Dave Anderka, who is a longtime kettlebell athlete and coach based out of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. We dive in on his background, kettlebell sport in Canada, his coaching philosophy, the challenges of being both a coach and an athlete come competition day, and much more. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I enjoyed having it. Of course, I'm incredibly grateful that you listen to this podcast. If you haven't already, please be sure to leave a rating and review of the Platform Podcast in your app of choice. Support my work by supporting our sponsors, whose affiliate links you'll find in the episode notes. And of course, if you want help reaching your goals without wasting time, please fill out the coaching interest form linked in the episode notes. I help athletes of all levels using my integrated coaching approach. You can follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at Twin Cities Kettlebell Club, or email me at twincitieskettlebellclub@gmail.com. Now, let's step onto the platform with Dave Anderka.
Yeah.
All right, welcome into this week's episode of the Platform Podcast. I am very excited about this one. This one has been a long time in the making. I have my boy, Dave Anderka, the Agatsu OG from Ottawa, Canada. He has been a kettlebell lifter, a kettlebell sport coach for many, many years. And if you don't know who Dave is, go give him a follow on Instagram. Look him up. He's got all sorts of cool stuff and he is a wealth of knowledge. And he's one of the few people I can say has been in this kettlebell sport game longer than I have in North America. So Dave, thank you so much for coming on to the Platform Podcast.
Hey, Jordan, it's my pleasure. And it's my pleasure to be here. Long time listener, long time fan, first time participant. So great to be here, man.
Yeah, I've been threatening to have you on for way too long, and finally we're just like, hey, let's actually book a time and make it happen. That conversation literally happened yesterday, and we're recording today. So I appreciate the flex around the holidays, and I know you've got a competition coming up. So why don't you give it a quick plug?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is our Agatsu OG Winter Classic. And we've been running this comp for about 8 years now. We kind of sort of settled into the post-Christmas time slot for the last few years. But it's been great. We do, under IKO, we do GS lifting. We do mace lifting as well. And we just last year added pentathlon. And this year are adding half marathon lifting to it as well. So we're kind of a little bit of an everything comp, where we'll try to get, you know, encourage all that grassroots lifting that that is so needed by this sport, and also give opportunity to our professional lifters or semi-professional lifters and our new sport lifters like mace. And to be fair, marathon in Canada is a fairly new sport. So give opportunity to that as well. Nice. So yeah, it's going to be great. We're going both in person and online on January 13th, and the 2 days bracketing that, January 12th and January 14th, for virtual lifting.
Okay, cool. So if somebody's hearing this podcast and they want to sign up and they're like, I don't want to go to Ottawa in January, or it's too short notice to make the trip, they can still sign up and do video submission for any of the events, for any, even for Mace, or is it just for kettlebell sport that they can do?
It's for kettlebell sport, for Mace, for pentathlon. We're still trying to figure out the right dynamics or the logistics for marathon, as our marathon coaches have only kind of committed to being present for the in-person lift.
Yeah.
I'll see if we can twist some arms and get them lifting for
I'll raise my hand for you. If you need somebody to help judge some video marathon sets, I will raise my hand for you. Cause I'm probably sending one of my guys. Greg Anderson was talking to me yesterday, and he was debating between coming in person or doing a video submission. I said I would talk to you about it and see what was what. And I did tell him that no matter what, you're going to put on a good competition. It's going to be a good time. And I said, there might be some quality cocktails involved in the after party.
I'm not going to say no, but it's a distinct possibility that there's to be some fine whiskeys, some other cocktails, and some celebrations happening.
Awesome. That's fantastic. Well, I hope you get a huge, turnout. Now, I do have to ask though, Ottawa in January, like, what precipitated the decision to, I mean, that's a bold strategy, Cotton. Like, why did you guys decide, like, hey, let's see who's really a glutton for punishment.
There's a reason we call it the Winter Classic, right?
It's Ottawa, not outdoors, is it? Like the NHL.
Huh. So here's the thing. It's Ottawa is a great town. We've got, you know, full four seasons here, and there's lots to see. There's lots to do, but there's lots to see and do through the entire year. Trying to run a comp in the summer, you're running with a lot of stiff competition on this continent, in the sport, anywhere you go. And so trying to find and slot a spot in is kind of tough, because you don't want to have, you know, a lot of lifters want to either support the comps that they know or the people that they know, or they're just going to try to do as much as possible, and then they're going to need some of that downtime.
Yeah.
And so we thought, okay, we were looking around, and, you know, right around Christmas seemed to be where we were falling before, pre-pandemic. And then through the pandemic,
there was a lot of
like, I don't want to organize shit, and I'm stuck at home, and I'm, you know, the whole world was feeling a little bit smaller and a little bit, stir crazy. And so I thought, you know what, let's wait until after the hassle, like all the hustle of Christmas and the holidays.
I think you had it right the first time.
Yeah. You know, let's see if we can locate it afterwards, get it happening afterwards. And it's been well received that way.
Yeah.
You know, I've been running another event for the last probably 12 years, which is where we do 1,000 swing in for the new year. And that kind of revved people up for the comp happening in mid-January. So I thought, this is a dynamic that works. So let's get people revved up. We'll get them sort of woken up after their Christmas turkey, goose, ham, whatever your fancy is, and then get them ready and pumped for the for a comp in mid-January.
Awesome.
Now, again, your evaluation of Ottawa in mid-January, not a great time, but you know what? It's how better to find some warmth than to lift with friends, to do a sport and that you gotta love to do, and get through this the long winter up here.
Yeah, for sure. I actually, you know, it's one of those, I think you and I kind of, we choose where we live intentionally, right? It's like you choose to live there because you like having four seasons. And it's one of those things I always explain to people. They're like, I can't believe you live there. How do you survive the winter? And I'm like, I love the winter. I still go out, I still do things. I get outside and I do shit. I have winter clothes. I still go ruck. I still go, like, you just put on heavier layers. And like, it's like, if you embrace it and you find the things that bring you joy in those different seasons, you know, like there's people around here, I don't know if it's big up there, but cross country skiing is huge up here. You know, like there's a ton of people that's what they do in the wintertime for exercise, or, you know, there's all sorts of things. Like if you actually, embrace it and enjoy it. Like you end up the season, you enjoy all of the seasons then. And it's not a detriment. So for me personally, I have no problem. Like I'll be happy to come to Ottawa in January if I can make the travel work. Right. But it's, I think it's a mindset thing, right? For those of us that are acclimated to the winters, we're like, I don't, it's just normal for me. Like I love it. So.
Well, and that's it. I think being Canadian means that you get tired of things and you like variety. And so I just get tired of summer. And so it's, you know, what better place to be than have something that has got some variety there. But yeah, I'm right on the edge of sort of where our city buildup kind of happens. And just north of me is a massive wilderness park with cross-country ski trails and trail running trails and just snowshoeing. A lot of people, fat biking is huge around here right now.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I always fat bike, whether it's summer, fall, it doesn't matter that, but that's just a description of me on a bike. But,
I was going to say that's sort of me on a bike, right? It's like, hey, look at that.
Fat tires for people that don't know what we're talking about yet. You take a regular bike, blow up the tires to like, you know, monster truck size and they can go through anything. It's a little bit harder to push them, but they can go through damn near anything. It's actually super fun. It's kind of like mountain biking, but in the snow.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, we're a big sports and outdoor area. We're also the type of city, both Ottawa and Gatineau, that is, if you think of nightlife and partying and all that, you're probably not going to pick Ottawa as your first town, first place to go. But if you want to think about outdoors and such and real, you know, real good sense of community and also a city with a little bit of a European vibe to it, it's a great spot. And so it's a great spot to encourage tourism for, and to get events happening. There's lots of events, lots of event spaces. So it's a great spot.
I'm gonna out myself here. I just now put together the double reference of the Agatsu OG. I just now realize it's Ottawa Gatineau as well as OG in the normal. Yeah, it's a nice play on words there. I'm just slow on the uptake. Other people probably got it.
Listen, that's all good. Everyone's gonna see it in their own way, and that's kind of what I liked about it more than anything else was that, you know what, you're gonna get the out of those sorts of things what you want and what you see. So
hearkening to the way my brain went with the OG component of the OG mm-hmm. moniker, you've been in this game a long time. I've known you for years. For people that don't know you, like, how did you get into this crazy sport? go back as far as you want. Like, what was your origin story for how did you come up? What did you do growing up? When did you discover kettlebells? And how did you get into, like, I'm going to lift weird heavy objects for funsies?
Weird heavy ass object. Yeah. So I guess I came to this like so many others through martial arts, right? And I think that there was a big push in the early 2000s to get like kettlebells were finding themselves more and more into martial arts clubs. And that's what I had was my I'd been training in traditional karate and some grappling arts and such, and my sensei at one point said, you got to try this thing. I don't know anything else that works the same way. And so you got to try this thing. It's called he was French. So it kind of came around, a kettlebell.
A kettlebell.
And and so it had this, you know, and sort of ears perked up and said, what? And so I tried it a couple times and didn't like it at all. I thought, this is ass. I feel like I'm going to throw up and don't want to do this ever again. But then I started using them more and more, and I thought, you know, this is really interesting, but there's got to be more to it than what I'm learning from my sensei. And you know, if you come through the martial arts, there's often a lot of that mentality of, you know, you only need one teacher for the thing. And you know.
Sensei knows best.
Yes, exactly. But he really encouraged to sort of go and you know, go and explore, and this is who I learned from, and this is who else is out there. And I ended up getting a coach in Ottawa who had been a longtime RKC guy. And he was a former Army officer and, or Army Sergeant Major, rather, the Canadian equivalent, my apologies. And so he had that regimented ability to break things down and to get people going further and further and further, harder, go, 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 go. And so very quickly, I ended up finding a little bit of a passion for it. And my sensei invited me to start teaching classes at the dojo. And then fast forward, and then I ended up pursuing the Canadian kettlebell, father of all of the lifters up here, Sean Mosen with Agatsu. And so in 2007, I think that's sort of the time frame we're looking at, I ended up taking one of his certification courses and just loved it. Thought this Sean guy seems crazy enough that I could start learning more shit from him. And through Agatsu, started learning, seeing the inklings of like Indian clubs and doing a lot of body weight, not gymnastics based, but not only circus based, but sort of an amalgam of, body control, whether you're using kettlebell or using a club or using another person, has got so much benefit on how you move around in every day. That I thought, oh, this might be sort of some of the stuff that I might be missing.
Yeah, the kinesthetic awareness that comes from some of that is really incredible. And I gotta give you props where it's due. When I watch you do some of your crazy fancy Indian club stuff, some of those fancy patterns, like I know that you've rehearsed them a lot and you've practiced them a lot, but they look so fluid, and like being able to move a club in each hand in different directions and things like that. Like people don't realize like how hard that is to get your brain to repattern that way and to be able to coordinate that way. And like the value of that type of kinesthetic and proprioceptive awareness just in life is incredible. So like props to you on the Indian club thing. How long have you practiced with Indian clubs and gada as well? And gada is just another word for mace, for those of you that aren't aware. So how long have you practiced with that? Did that all come together at the same time, or was it a different journey?
That was a few years later. I know that through Agatsu, Sean started, he had always had sort of exposure to those tools, but then, the saying that the teacher comes when you're ready. He also sort of, I think, recognized that, okay, maybe the world isn't ready yet for working with Indian clubs. Bowling pins, you're going to be spinning bowling pins? I don't get it. Right?
Yeah.
And similarly to sort of, you mentioned proprioceptive and body control, working with breath control and breath work that is so dominant out there now. And he was sort of saying, well, I don't know if the world is ready for that yet. People barely look at a kettlebell and think, boy, you're going to hurt yourself.
Is that right? Bad for your back? Isn't that bad for your back?
You know what? You really shouldn't be lifting that heavy. Yeah. So I think that was a progression that I was very happy to be along for the ride of when, as it developed through Agatsu to then get, and as soon as Sean was saying, well, let's put enough together for an Indian clubs workshop and for a mace workshop. And so that was a few years later, after I'd already been doing kettlebell for a while. This is before I was even involved in kettlebell sport, but I was starting to see the lessons learned from Indian club, which is, you're working with a light tool. You're working not just muscle control, but muscle subtlety and that ability to work the volume dial. Right. To work the intensity dial.
Dynamic energy control, as we call it.
Yeah. 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 I've seen people pick up an Indian club and they'll do like, and they'll be smacking the thing into the air and then coming away saying, ow, and not realizing that they're going full tilt on
tiny muscles,
yeah. Or on really, really sensitive joints. And so, I took that to heart and sort of started thinking, okay, well, there's got to be a way of dialing all that down and being able to be reactive to situations, to weights, and to all that stuff. The gada or the mace were very similarly along the same learning process. So those two kind of came up together. Steel clubs and heavy clubs as well were part of that. And then I think it was probably 2013 that I went to my first kettlebell comp. I'd been looking at that, and the one lesson that I took away from some of those original kettlebell courses was that this is a submaximal weight, but here we're just going to slam our body against it, and we're going to bash our body against it. And Sean was the first one to really sort of say, it's like, it's a submaximal weight. Don't use it in the same way you would use a maximal weight. There's got to be, sort of look at it differently.
Yeah.
So I was playing with that, and kettlebell sport kind of fit right into it, because I was also looking at, well, if I can't slam my body and use maximal energy, then I've got to look at endurance energy. And hey, that kind of was describing this thing called kettlebell sport.
Yeah. And it's also describing this thing called martial arts too, right? Because if you watch watch anybody who's a good boxer, a good MMA fighter, a good jiu-jitsu fighter, right? If you ever seen like Renzo Gracie on his back, he looks like he could take a nap down there, right?
Because he's having a nap down there.
Because he's not working so hard, because he knows that this is a fight, and the person that gets tired first loses, right? And and that's one of the things that I think, especially as amateurs, like, if you come up in any martial arts, right, I did like Muay Thai and boxing and some of the more, alpha aggro type of and I would come in and I would throw every punch as hard as I could, because I could throw hard punches. And it wasn't until my first boxing instructor was like, you don't throw every punch with bad intentions. He's like, all I got to do is outlast you for the first 2 minutes, and you're gas, and I'm gonna whoop your ass in the next three rounds. Right. Because you've used all of your energy. Right. And so that's where, if you look at good boxers, you look at good fighters, right, what do? Well, that dynamic energy control, right? They don't throw every punch with the worst intentions. Sometimes they're just floating their jab out there to get distance. They're just sticking and moving. Right. But then when it comes time, they throw a punch with bad intentions, and you're like, oh, holy shit, that was fast.
Holy shit.
Right?
Well, I think, I mean, you look, going back to the UFC, and you look at Lyoto Machida and Anderson Silva, and, like, the guys who are really proficient really didn't look, even George St. Pierre. George St. Pierre has got a lot of fights that are just, like, boring, because he's just, playing distance. And I'm sorry, I'm playing the Canadian card with them.
GSP is, in my opinion, honestly, like, best of all time. Like, he's in the conversation for best pound for pound MMA fighter of all time, and that's like, that's a different conversation. But that's not the Canadian.
I know
card.
You
that's
guys are out game. There going to say, wait a sec, John Jones, come on, John Jones. But but I digress.
But I digress.
But it was very much that idea. Yeah, that idea of, okay, if you're going for a long period of time, why blitz every single rep? Why blitz every single, or tense every single muscle? There started to become that conversation of style, fitness style or hard style versus, sports style and
soft,
which was a
style.
Ridiculous,
it's soft style. Go give me a couple of 32s and see how many times you can lift both of them over your head in your hard style format. Let's see.
Yeah. But I mean, it's that need of humans to just categorize things it made a little bit of sense, but what they were just describing was intent.
Yeah.
It was the intent of, my intent is to get maximum tension, or my intent is to have maximum endurance. Yeah. And so, and as I was getting, I was becoming an older athlete as well. I think I came into the sport and I was already, I'd be in my early 40s, right? Which isn't walking around old, but sport is a little aged. However, in this sport, it seemed to be, well, that's kind of where people start finding where they're going to hit their stride and find their prime. And so I really liked that. And you know, ended up sort of starting to do some comps and really kind of enjoy it. At the time, there weren't a lot of competitions around. I don't know about the US. The US is a little bit more affordable to travel in, but in Canada, it's, you know, for me to go to Vancouver is about $1,000 Canadian.
It's
a good expense. For me to go to Winnipeg, which is halfway across the country, it's about the same amount. So, you know, traveling in Canada can be a bit pricey. And so we were traveling to the other side, which is where the official, at the time, the official kettlebell organization for the country was based. And they did everything out there. They didn't do anything.
Was that CKA? Was that CKA back then?
Yeah. And so it became and it created some not great feelings. And that's when Agatsu was starting to do their own competitions, and they were doing a couple comps a year because there was no one else. There was no other show.
Yeah.
And they started. They're the first kettlebell comp in Canada, as far and longest continually running kettlebell sport comp in Canada. And I think they started in 2012. And I know that in Niagara, our friend Jen Hintenberger, she's been running, she ran the NKSO for years as well. And so those two comps for Eastern Canada, that was the show. And so we went down and we supported what we could, and and then I think 1 year, I'm trying to think of when it was, I think it was 2015, the fellows who had been running the comps, the Agatsu comps down in Toronto, said, you know what, I think we can't do this anymore. And and I got asked if I would consider running it, because I had always been that guy helping out, you know, always. Yeah. Helping out with judging, with running it, with collating information and setting things up. And so that's what I did. And nice. I've been doing it ever since.
So when you got started, what was your lift of choice? What was the first, did you do biathlon? Did you do long cycle? Were you crazy from the get go and did all three, or how did you get started?
So I did, 16 kilo two arm long cycle and 16 kilo snatch.
Oh, so you were one of those, a long cycle and snatch person.
Yeah, I loved doing snatch. I thought that was great. I thought it was a lot of fun. And I got, for snatch for me is the closest to moving meditation that I've ever found in this sport, right? And jerks are
awesome, fun, you know, amazing, wonderful, the best. Sorry, I'm campaigning hard for jerks.
No.
Everybody hates on jerks.
But here's the thing: is that I started, long cycle is a polarizing lift as well, and a lot of people have a hard time with longs. I think more people are attracted to snatch, even though there are some very opinionated persons out there against them. But you know,
snatch is just like the neediest lift. It's just so needy. You got to pay attention to every little detail for the entire 10 minutes.
If you can get into that, you know,
if you can find your flow, it's amazing. It's amazing. When you find your flow, it's great.
You can find that flow. Yeah. And so that's, it's funny because I'll demonstrate stuff to my athletes and you know, I'll say, okay, what did you see? And I'm thinking in my head, I'm demonstrating this thing, and everyone sort of comes back and says, stop making it look so easy. And so it's like, fuck, I didn't think it was easy. Okay, well, let's
didn't
see
feel
if we can
easy.
Look at this. Right? Yeah, exactly. But it really is that lift that is the closest to just sort of breathing.
Yeah.
Right. In snatch, I'll end up oftentimes closing my eyes and just drowning everything else out. And all I hear is just my breath, and not hard breath, just this flow, this waves of the ocean hitting a beach sort of breathing. And,
I always get in, I always get into the music. It's that's one of the things that people always always even in my first competition set. I was so fortunate that in the first competition set I ever did on Snatch, one of my favorite songs came on in the middle of the set, and it was Voodoo Child Slight Return by Jimi Hendrix, which is one of my favorite songs.
Yeah.
And it happens to be exactly 5 minutes long. And it came on, like right as I switched hands. So I switched to, from my non-dominant hand to my dominant hand. I'd hit my goal pace on my left hand. I switched it, and I knew I was going to hit my, my target number. And I just just found that groove, like we were talking about. And just like, I was just like, and while I'm lifting, I'm like jamming out to the song and singing. And people are like, I've literally never seen anybody sing while they're on the platform, you know? And it was like, I found my groove, and I just was in the, I was in my flow state. I was well conditioned for what pace I was doing. I was on the right weight, and it was awesome. We won't talk about my long cycle set, but I do love that about Snatch, where it's like, when you find that groove, the rest of the world can fade away. You can go into your body however you do that, and then you're just present, right? And that's just such a unique experience, at least for me. Like, when the mind goes quiet and you can really be fully present in your body, that is such an incredible thing to be able to tap into. And you can almost tap into it at will.
I found that with also with Mace, right? And I remember being on a platform, and it was in the early days when we first started bringing Mace to the competitions. And I was lifting next to Zach Yannick from Saskatchewan, and it was his first comp, and he came out and he said, "Can I make a song request?" I said, "Yeah, man, of course." He picks Fleetwood Mac, Chain, and it just starts, and it established that rhythm. I still beat him. But it was such a good rhythm to actually, Zach, I don't know if I did or not, so forgive me for saying that. But I really got to say it. If you can get into any of those patterns, right, find a beat, find a pace that you can sort of just turn off that, you know, the inner voices are the liars, right? They're the ones who are saying, "You're not good enough. This sucks. You're in pain.
Put it down. You're going to die. Hand, your whatever."
Yeah. "You did better last time. You know, you don't need to prove anything. This, you know," all that stuff, all that shit that we're all walking around with. You can drown out those inner voices or let them go and just focus on a pace, focus on a rhythm. You're golden. You're golden.
Yeah, I love it.
I tell my athletes that if you don't know why you joined this sport, then it's going to get real hard real fast, right? Or if you don't know why you joined, then let me put it this way, is that we lift because we love it, right? We lift because we love. That's sort of the thing that I try to bring to all of this, is that, you know, there are better ways to lift weight, and there are more satisfying ways to lift weight. And you're going to make progress at a glacially slow pace once you start finding your spot. So if you don't love it, you know, you're not going to enjoy lifting it. So you got to love something and find that love of the sport. So that's something that has always stuck with me. So whether you love the music, you love what your body can do, you love, you know, sort of the community or the the support of your peers, you got to love something about this sport. So
yeah, you got to find your why that keeps you showing up, because like you said, once you've gotten past your newbie gains phase and you've kind of started getting to like, okay, I achieved the top rank that I could achieve in my first, like, where my body is right now. And now that I've learned the technique and everything, right? Like, it's always fun to see like how fast people go from being like a fucking noob to like a proficient lifter, and they're like, oh, they went from like rank 3 to CMS in 2 years. And then they're like, okay, now I want to get master of sport and I want to do it in the next year. You're like, yeah, No.
Yeah.
You know, or like, dude. I hit rank one and now I'm going for CMS. You're like, I don't want to do it in the next 6 months. You're like, probably not.
Let's come with me. Let's sit down for a moment and let's have a little chat.
So this is a good segue. This was not a professional segue, but this is a good segue. I want to talk to you a little bit more about, we talked about you as an athlete, but you as a coach, when did you start coaching? How many athletes do you work with now? And like, what is kind of your philosophy as a coach in kettlebell sport?
So I guess I started coaching very quickly before I even got sort of the professional, you know, coach's certification or became officially a coach. Given that I'd come from martial arts and I was already a long time black belt, so I was already teaching kids and teaching adults and that, and the kettlebell kind of fit into that. So those skills felt very transferable over to what I was doing within the martial arts world. And then I started doing more and more stuff on my own and more stuff with students. And my students saw me at a competition and said, can we do that too? And it's like, yeah, sure. Why not? And so, and I got everyone through that newbie stage of okay, we're lifting 12 kilos or we're lifting 16 kilos and then, you know, up to lifting, you know, the 16 and 20 kilos or maybe a couple 24s and everyone was just sort of feeling it like, okay, this is great. And then for the longest time, and myself included, sort of hit, everyone was feeling like we were hitting up against the ceiling. And I thought, you know, traditional or, you know, the coaches or the trainers or even the athletes who come to this sort of by accident, and I do consider myself a lucky accident.
We all are.
By coming to it by accident, I sort of thought, well, clearly we have to train harder. We got to go
do more.
And
do
we gotta, more. Yeah, exactly. Said, oh, you can't lift that for 5 minutes. Okay, well, we're going to train it to lift for six. We're going to go for, you know, can't do, you know, eight reps, fine, we're going to train you at 10. And did a few years of me, and I use myself as an example all the time because I find myself as my biggest example of sometimes what not to do and biggest example of what to do.
Yeah.
I also suffer from a great deal of imposter syndrome as well. But that idea of, okay, well, this works, so let me tell you a story and let's see if it'll work for you. But I kept on hitting this ceiling. And then I ended up getting a professional coach, a professional kettlebell sport coach. And I've been with her ever since. And it's Abby Johnston in the UK, Scotland. And Abby is amazing. And Abby is this incredible phenom who, you know, I'm constantly in awe of her abilities and her work. But also, what got me with Abby, which was why I didn't necessarily pursue other coaches, was that Abby could talk about it from a perspective that I really understood, that I really kind of got. And it's like, you know, and the first thing she told me was, I think you're doing too much. I think you need to calm down. And you need to slow down and do, you know, little segments and have a bit of a more metered approach to it. And that suddenly got me from sort of tapping out a 20 kilo snatch set at, say, you know, 150 reps to suddenly going to comp and getting, you know, 180. And then 185, and then 190. And then I broke 200 with the 24 kilo belt. And I thought, damn, okay, yep, the process works, trust the coach, yes, coach. And I had trusted her all along, but it's, you know, I've been doing it already for about 10 years at that point. Yeah. And it was like, yeah, sure, okay, I'll do what you say, coach. And then say, yeah, but I'm gonna do my own thing.
This episode is brought to you by Pro Kettlebell, the only competition kettlebell made in the USA. They're changing the game with two sizes of their patented kettlebell shape that is designed with anatomical cutaways that distribute the weight more evenly on lifter's forearm for faster snatches, crisper cleans, and more comfortable rack position on jerks. Plus, their wide base makes it more stable for push-ups, planks, and rows. And they're also designed for their level-up magnetic chip weights to fit perfectly inside, allowing you to incrementally add 1 or 2 kilos to your bells so that you can keep progressing safely without changing the physics on your ballistic lifts and saving a ton of space in your garage. Click the link in the episode notes or go to prokettlebell.com to shop now. And don't forget to use code TCKB10 to get 10% off your order.
And
so, or in the back of your mind, you're like, why the fuck am I doing it like this? or you get the little voice in the back of your head that's like, that wasn't hard enough. You didn't work hard enough. You didn't feel enough pain in that workout. Yeah. Ergo, you're not making progress.
And you know, and even to this day, I'm in my mid-50s. When I get an injury or I tweak my elbow or I've got long time back issues, when my back flares up and I've got to tell my coach, it's just like, Abby, I'm sorry, I hurt my thing. And she's like, okay. And then 2 weeks later, when I'm lifting, I'm looking at the programming and thinking, why has she got me lifting 16s again? This doesn't make sense. Why am I lifting 16s when I could be lifting 20? You know, and because I've got zero memory. I've got, you know, no memory. And this is why I put myself wholeheartedly. And I think finding a good coach is so important. So getting back to this, back to finding a coach, I look at her and think, she's an amazing coach and so aware of what's going on, even if she's not necessarily aware that she's aware of it. Mm. And I find myself saying things to my own athletes and say, you know what, you really need to trust your legs a whole lot more in that lift and get out of your own head. Mm. And they'll all of a sudden, like, I don't know where that came from, but okay, trust my legs. Holy shit, you were right. And you know, so as a coach, what my process is trusting instincts based on my own experience of, you know, calm my own shit, calm down. And that's coming so much from Abby and by extension too, I think by her coach as well. But every good athlete and good coach needs a good coach. So right now I've got about 24 athletes that are in varying stages of their process, whether they are stepping on a platform at every comp they can make, whether they are doing it for that strength endurance component. I do also teach a few people just kettlebell fitness, quote unquote fitness, or hard style. Or a high intensity workouts. But everything is done through that lens of you're using a submaximal weight. So keep that in mind when you're trying to get that fitness component too, is like, what else are you doing to help trigger certain components? And if I want people to help build maximal strength, then I do have to defer because fortunately I'm part of a group where I can defer. I said, you really need to go learn some deadlifting technique, some maximal weightlifting technique from this guy. And he's awesome. So go give him a call. Let's get you guys together and do some things with them. So, Sorry, what was the question again?
I asked three. So, you know, it was really, wasn't really professional interviewing skills there, but you answered it well. I love it. And I'm going to ask a favor. I want you to just give me a warm intro to Abby. Like I know who Abby is, but I don't think she and I have ever interacted beyond me like commenting on her Facebook post. I'd love to have her on this podcast because I can say
100%.
I can say unequivocally, I have used her technique as an example of various things to do with my athletes more times than is fair to her without me having ever told her that, because she is a phenomenal lifter. In addition to being an excellent coach, she is a phenomenal lifter, a world-class lifter. So I would love to have Abby on the podcast as well. So I'm gonna ask you for an intro, because I don't want to be that weird creeper that's like, hey, I've been following you for years on social media, but I've never reached out before.
No, 100%. I mean, and that's definitely sort of a pay it forward sort of thing. I got the intro to Abby and to Eddie through Jen Hintenberger. If you ever have the opportunity to go and take, because they do, I don't know if they're still running workshops, but a workshop with Abby and Eddie is going to give you stuff for years to digest. And I still go back and look through her notebook, and admittedly, I don't lift exactly like how Abby or Eddie lift, but everything that they taught me and told me is in consideration of anything that, you know, anytime that I'm taking on.
Well, and nor should you. And I doubt she would say that you should, right? Yeah. Because one of the things that I think great coaches have in common is the ability to take, fundamentals and distill them down to what we call first principles, right? Like there's more than one way for anybody to move the bell efficiently overhead in a snatch, but it should come from a good counterbalance. It should come from a good pendulum. It should come from an efficient upswing, right? All of those things. How that looks mm-hmm. is different for different people based on their body type, right. Based on their experience, based on how they're used to moving, injuries, all sorts of things, right? Like, you know, you have a history of back in issues. I have a history of back issues, right? I probably shouldn't go to as deep of a hinge and put as much lumbar flexion into my snatch as somebody else might, right? Like, those are things that good coaches can either intuitively understand, like you said, or they can look at the film, or they can look at your injury history and say, oh yeah, maybe a full like 90 degree hinge here is not a good idea for you. Like, let's try and get you to 120 degrees and see how that works. Right. Like, that's, you know, I think that's the thing.
Yeah. I think you did ask too, what is your process? And there's something else that really, I think, sticks out for a large part, because If you're teaching kettlebell sport, chances are you're teaching the athletes that you get, whether they're new intake or existing lifters who are coming over, they've got experience, and they've got a wealth of experience that has defined what technique they're using or what they're doing. And I want to look at everyone to see whether it's you're doing a single rep lift, or you're doing, a 10-minute set, or you're doing a half hour or an hour set, is your technique, do you have that conscious effort to get rid of the stuff that you don't need, right? Get rid of the movement that you don't need. I remember, and I'll use snatch as sort of that, you know, example technique, but I remember we used to do snatch where we'd pull it from the back, from the backswing and punch it to the overhead position, right? And that was very hard, styly, but quote unquote. But it was that sense of, you know, just sort of grip it and rip it and punch it through the ceiling. And it's like, okay, well, how much of that can we get rid of? And you can either get rid of the individual components within that system, or you can redefine the system. And you start sort of rocking your body back and forth and focus on pendulum and focus on counterbalance. And all of a sudden, you don't need to rip it from the backswing, because pendulums just kind of go by themselves. And you don't need to punch the ceiling, because if you're counterbalancing back, you're kind of an arm's length away from the bell with enough kick in it, and it just kind of floats right on up there.
Yeah.
So partly get rid of the shit that you don't need. And partly define the technique well enough that you don't actually have the shit that you don't need cropping up in the first place.
Yeah. Well, and there might still be value, especially when you go to the heavier weights like 28s and 32s for men, right? There might still be value in, as you get to fixation, you tense your lat just to stop the movement, right? And stabilize your shoulder. But as soon as it's stable, you relax, right? It's like, right. There's that, like, be as efficient as possible. And I've had a lot of people, if they're being a little too casual with their insertion, I'll tell them, like, I call it the choke slam insertion, like grab, punch your hand into that bell as though you're going to get ready to choke slam somebody like the Undertaker. Right. But then as soon as you do that, then just let the momentum carry you to 12 o'clock and then we're going to fixate there. But you know, I am 100% with you. It's all about those, like, identifying where do I need to engage and where do I need to relax? And it should be a system, and it should be a chain of, like, engage, relax, engage, relax, engage, relax. And it's figuring out that sequence and then marrying that sequence up to your breath pattern and quieting those voices in your head that are telling you you can't do this or,
bingo,
you know, any of those things. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you mentioned imposter syndrome a little bit, and we talked about this offline a little bit, and it's I told you I was going to bring it up because this is something you and I have in common. I think I said something to you. I don't remember specifically the exact wording, but you asked me at RealStruck how I felt about my own lift, and you know, and I said, oh, I felt fine about it. I don't really care. I'm here to be a good coach and a mediocre lifter, right? Yeah. Because that is. I mean, if I'm being honest, like, that's generally how I perceive myself most of the time. But we had a conversation around that, and I'm curious, what are your thoughts around the challenges between being a good coach and being a good lifter, and how do you decide where you focus most of your energy, and how do you manage that polarity, as I like to call it, right? Because it's a little bit of a challenge to manage both of those things, especially on comp day when you've got multiple athletes who might be lifting at a competition, and you might also have a set.
Yeah. That is that sort of eternal juggle that I'm not quite sure if I do manage. I've been doing this long enough that there's so much that sort of falls into autopilot, where we're just like, okay, let's get the next one up. We're going to start right at that time, and we're going to do this. We have to have this. So the actual comp day conversation, my partner Mediev, she sees me all the time, and whether we're traveling to a comp, whether we're hosting it or we're hosting a comp here in town, she knows that I'm probably going to get really quiet. I'm probably not going to eat. I'm probably not going to, you know, fuel my own self very well. So from that perspective, not going to sleep.
Yeah.
Right. She knows that I'm sort of, you know, a hot mess beforehand, but once things start, like, you get up on that platform and say, you know, okay, everybody, let's get together. We're going to have a little chat about the rules. We're going to have a little conversation about the different lifts, what we're looking at, and get things going. Then it just kind of rolls.
Yeah.
So from comp perspective, that just kind of rolls. And when I have to get on the platform to lift, I have got amazing people on my team. I mentioned Mediev. She is sort of that backbone of organization that, you know, she runs, you know, a lot of the data entry and sort of,
that's the Dr. Sarah's for me. Dr. Sarah's, yeah. they are my freaks in the sheets right there. They manage all those Excel spreadsheets so well, and it helps take so much pressure off of me. Like, so Dr. Sarah's Fornero and Summers, I cheers to you. And then
salutes to you guys, salutes to Mediev as well.
Yeah.
And then I've got some really just this amazing team of lifters who have gone to enough competitions, and we've driven down to Toronto from here. It's about a 4-hour drive, driven to Montreal, driven, you know, a couple different comps here and there, where we know the patterns. Like, okay, look, you know, can I grab you, Tash, come over here. I need you to, you know, announce this, the next few lifts so that I can go warm up and then I can do my lift. And, you know, Kim, can you look at, make sure the judging is done well, and that sort of thing. So it is, there is a little bit of this haphazard seat of your pants, but it's well rehearsed and
organized, you know, chaos.
Organized chaos. Yeah. And, you know, we've been trying to live stream all of our comps. And so, you know, at some point you'll hear this sort of manic, you know, yell across the room, Tash, where are you? Or whatever. Said, is everyone ready? And you know, you'll get the try to get the people pumped up in the room, especially when you're going into so that late afternoon of the comp when everyone's just like, oh, I've been here since 9 a.m. We've done yet, right?
When do we get to the cocktails?
Yeah. did someone mention there was going to be beer? What's going on? So from a comp perspective, there's always that sort of like that persona. And I think you and I are very much the same, where maybe privately we're a little bit more introverted and we're a little bit more emotional
I am not introverted in any way, shape or form. I definitely can relate on a lot of the things you're talking about. Like, but my wife would be like, oh, are you going to go quiet at any point? Or is that only when you die? Because that's my personality.
Fair enough. But maybe emotional is the other thing, but you know, yeah. I'm very sensitive about certain things, and so I need to have a little bit of quiet time. And you know, after
we're both introspective. I can definitely like we're both very introspective and reflective. Like I think it just manifests a little bit differently.
But when it's game day, quote unquote game day, it's like you get that facade of Coach Dave and Announcer Dave and Personality Dave, and I'm just like on and loud, and you know, I'll be there as long as the lifters are lifting and you know, we go. My athletes know that for the most part, so that when it does come time for game day, I'll try to make a point of having a couple words with them before their lift, like, you know, whatever it is, you know, whether I'm talking to Chris and I said, you got this, you know, it'll be awesome. Or I'm talking to Kim where it's like, don't you put that shit down or it, you know, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you get to know your people and you know either exactly what they need or, you know, sort of the tone of what they need.
Yeah.
You know, like whether they need a punch in the arm or a big hug or, you know, just a moment to hold hands and just calm down. So I try to do that as much as I can. Comp day is kind of nutty and crazy.
But I think the sign of a good coach, and maybe this is confirmation bias, but I think the sign of a good coach is that you're focused so much on your athletes that, and you want to teach them how to manage it themselves, right? You're trying to build independence so that, you know, and that's not always going to be like their first competition. You're like, I'm going to be there with you. I'm going to be there counting all your reps. Right. You know, like you're trying to bear hug them when they're first in the sport, but like Sarah Fornero, you know, she can just give me a look on the platform. I've been coaching her long enough that like I'll be like, all right, here we go. That was 10. And I'll look at her, we going to 12. And she'll just give me a look. And I'm like, okay, we're not going to 12. Or, you know, she knows, she could just verbally, like non-verbally communicate with me, but like she knows how to manage her own sets so well with or without me. Right. And like, you know, that's, you always get to that. Try and get to that point where your athletes are so prepared and you've talked to them ahead of time that they know what to expect on comp day. And comp day is just a repeat of the routine that we've already built. It's about managing our nerves on that day. We already have our strategies. We have our plan A, plan B, plan C, right? And like, you're just giving them, like you said, the two word reminders of like, hey, under squat, leg drive and under squat or whatever, right? Like relax into fixation or stay with your breath or whatever it is for that person, you know, and
100%.
You're just trying to build 100%. That. You're trying to build that where it's like, even if you weren't there, they're hearing your voice. They're hearing your voice. They're hearing your words in their head, and they know what to do. They know how to execute. And I'm always, I don't know, for me personally, like I'm always so much more proud of my athlete. Like I've never been as proud of any of my own sets as I've ever been for any of my athletes. Like when my athletes go out and crush their targets and they put up their best performances, that shit stays with me. My own sets, I pick apart and I'm like, oh, that sucked.
I'm glad you said that because that's exactly how I feel too. I mean, people have seen me in the audience, right? And I'm also, you know, whether I'm one of the officiants of the comp or I'm just there as a coach, I'll be there in the audience looking at my lifters doing, like, they'll be doing
you jerks, do air reps.
And I'll be there going, And I'll be doing these sort of false jokes along with them, and then either you know, clapping, yelling encouragement, or yelling, you know, like, okay, more of that, less shit, okay, and that sort of thing. So yeah, I'm with you, and yeah, what struck me is that I think I've had comps where I've had my own lifters up on the platform. I've been announcing that I have announced that I'm up next. And yet I'm still engaged in my lifter on the platform. And so then when that flight is done, I'll be announcing the next flight and I'll see my own name and I'll in my own head go, in some cases out loud, oh shit, I gotta lift next. And I haven't warmed up.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes I'll go out there and I'll shit the bed, or I'll go out there and I'll crush a PR. And it's just like, and I can't find in my own self any sense of consistency of personal prep. Whether I take half an hour and warm up for a lifting set, or I surprise myself and just say, oh crap, okay, throw chalk on my hands and go. Obviously there's some, you know, with some exceptions of just the extremely crappy lifts that I've done. But for the most part, I don't see any consistency between on game day, on comp day, having a great set from being super prepared or being not prepared at all.
Mm.
So that to me, I think is more attributed to the fact that I'm there with my lifters and I'm just so buoyed up by their own performance or their own, you know, emotions, and whether their emotions are super positive or super negative. You know, when I see a lifter crumble, and you know, and they're in tears, you can see that they're obviously disappointed. It's like I feel that.
Oh yeah.
And I go up to them and I'll sit with them and I'll say, okay, you know what, it's okay. You know, at least you didn't shit your pants. You know, or
and then they're like, I got news for you, coach.
Yeah, exactly. Or whatever it is to connect back with them. Yeah. So, you know, when trying to balance that, I get so much from my own lifters, and, you know, the pandemic, a lot of people had a hard time with the pandemic. I went online with my lifters right away.
Yeah.
And grew my client base.
Same.
And I've stayed online with them, with the exception of a single, I do 12 classes a week, 10 classes a week, sorry. And only one of them is in person right now, because everyone is just so busy and so occupied.
Well, and Canada's at least, fucking huge, right? Like that's the other part of it, huge, right? Yeah. Like you can coach people from Rankin Inlet, or, you know, they can be from Toronto. They can be from Ottawa. They can, you know, they could be three blocks down the street from you, and you still might only, like, I've got one of my athletes is literally 2 miles from me, and I see, like, I'm going to go meet him for coffee here in a little bit, but we don't lift in person together because he works as a nurse. He's got kids. I've got kids. I just deliver his programming. He sends me videos. He could be in freaking Atlanta and it wouldn't make any, like, we would still interact basically the same way as far as coaching him. Right. But, you know, that's, I think the double-edged sword
And even though he's online, you're still giving him as good as you've got. You just happen to be giving it, you know, by way of a screen.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it works so well, so that's to me, that's the business now. Where we're at. And
that's the sport now, whether people like it or not. Like, I love the feel of an in-person comp, and I will 100% say, if you have a chance to go lift in person, fucking do it, because there is nothing like comp day in person. But also, 100%. If it's a barrier for you, online competitions are still awesome. It's still a great way to compete, and it's still like the access that we now have, and all of those things. I think that's a net positive for almost everybody. But I'm going to ask you two more questions because I want to be respectful of your time, and I got to go meet Dave, for another Dave, a different Dave, for a coffee here in a couple minutes. So I'm going to ask you first, since I promised you we would talk bourbon a little bit, and I grabbed a quick top off of my bottle by my desk here. So what are you drinking, and what's your favorite either cocktail or bourbon that you're drinking right now?
Oh boy. Okay. So right now I'm actually drinking, this is a bit of a dark horse that sort of surprises people. I've been pulling this out and serving it to both my Scotch whiskey lovers, friends, and the ones who like bourbon as well and some rye. But I've been pulling out, it's a Canadian Club, but it's a 20-year Canadian Club. And Canadian Club is like high school whiskey.
Oh yeah, for
it's
sure.
Something that
pour Coca-Cola on top of and drink half a liter of it. And
yeah. And but my guy at the local liquor store gave me a taste of this in the store, and I was like, "What the hell is that? That's amazing!" And he told me the price of it first, and I know that Canadian prices are a little bit different from U.S., but this was just over $70 a bottle, which is US maybe about $50.
Yeah, but for 20-year aged Canadian whiskey, that's cheap.
For a 20-year aged Canadian whiskey, and I could pick up on rye, and I could pick up on notes. It was really, really a solid buy. So I thought, yep, I'll have one of those, please. So I thought, you know, to be topical and sort of. I think both of us sort of look like in sport, we both kind of look like a bit of a dark horse.
I resemble that remark, sir. I'm offended.
Today. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But when we get to bourbons, tell you, when I was down at Riddlestruck, Matt gave me a taste of Old Tub, which is, an unfiltered, sort of Jack Daniels,
Jim Beam. Beam distillery. Yeah.
And which was tasty, but then I also brought to the party four-grain Penelope.
The Penelope,
Penelope. Yeah. Which was fantastic and smooth.
Everything Penelope does is excellent. The architect is awesome. Their toasted barrel stuff is awesome. Like everything I've had from Penelope has been really, really good. Yeah. So really solid. That four grain was excellent. That's a very solid distillery.
Absolutely. But then I've also got a sipper there, with the third batch from 2022 of Booker's. So the good one. I know that they have got a lot of inconsistency in their batches.
Their batches are highly variant, which is, I'm glad that they label them and they name them and everything. And what one person really likes as a batch, another person might not, which is one of the fun things about bourbon is you start to learn kind of what your flavor profile is, and it evolves over time. And sometimes, and also it depends on the mood or the seasons, which is another thing that I really enjoy. Like people are like, oh, what are your winter whiskeys or what are your, you know, cause I move more towards higher rye, heavier spice, hot, generally what you would consider a hotter whiskey, you know, when it's colder outside. And I like my wheaters and my more citrusy and caramely stuff in the summertime. Yeah, and you know, it's interesting.
I'm not a fan of the weeders, so I see. I'm not a fan of the weeded ones.
Challenge accepted. Sir. Yeah, you get yourself down here for the TCKV, and I'll give you a flight of some weeders that are, and I'm not you're not wrong. Like there are some weeders that are just mediocre, and like they sacrifice smoothness for complexity, but there are some weeders that are just like. And like Pappy Van Winkle, for people that don't know, Pappy Van Winkle, most people have heard of, and it's really sought after. Like that's a wheat mash bill. So there are some really top end bourbons that have wheat in the mash bill. So I'll give you a few to try. And if you don't like them, you don't like them, and that's okay. Cause I got plenty other, I got some spicy high rye stuff and some other good stuff in there,
nice.
As well. So we'll,
I do have to say that, we have got the availability of good bourbon up here is sometimes kind of stretched, and it comes, you end up with a lot of the real run of the mill, or the high production bottles. But I was out in the West Coast, for a week and had and found a bottle of Old Forester 1920.
I have that upstairs, and I haven't opened it. Chocolate Bomb. That's one of my favorite bottles. Oh, oh, I love that bottle.
Yeah. So I thought, okay, well, I'm here for what we're there for 8 or 9 days. It's like, okay, let's at least make a dent in it. And ended up with about an inch and a half left in the bottle of the
made
bottle,
more than so. A dent. It's on life support.
Yeah, so it was good. It was good.
Yeah.
As far as cocktail, I mean, man, I love what Sam Ross did, and so I love a paper plane.
Oh, paper plane's awesome. Tell people the recipe because paper plane is one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's an all equal parts 4-part cocktail with bourbon, Amaro Nonino usually, although
get a good good Amaro
Montenegro. Yeah. With Aperol and lemon juice, and just like it just hits on all cylinders.
That's a summer cocktail to me. That's a summer cocktail.
Yeah. But then I love a Boulevardier.
Ooh, you fancy. A fancy bitch.
Which is a bourbon version of a Negroni.
I like a Gold Rush too. A Gold Rush is one of my favorite summer cocktails. Yeah. You can make that in bulk. Yeah, that's a good summer cocktail as well. That's honey, absolutely. Honey and lemon juice and sugar and bourbon. For people that don't know these things, by they're not bartender nerds like us.
I'll take a penicillin in that place, which is done more with scotch, just a generic blended scotch with honey syrup, ginger.
That's a good way to get rid of your Dewar's White Label, right? Like it'll do the trick.
True, and then you can float an Isla whiskey on top of it. Just to get that hard peat and that sort of iodine. So it tastes like drinking medicine, but, it's good.
It is.
It's good, man.
It is. It is. A well-crafted cocktail in the hands of a skilled practitioner is almost always a good bet. So, all right. 100%. So last question, and anybody that listens to the podcast knows what it is. So, you're an experienced lifter. You're an experienced coach. When you get a brand new person, if you could give them one piece of advice, they're not hiring you as a coach, but they're like, hey, I can't afford a coach, but I want one piece of advice. What would you tell a brand new lifter as the one thing that you would give them to get them started? What's the one piece of advice that you would give them?
Always ask questions. Always ask questions. If you don't understand it, then ask a question. If you don't know why you're doing it, ask a question. If your coach can't answer those questions, you're with the wrong guy. You know, find another coach. So ask the question and make sure that the answers make sense to you, that you understand what your coach is trying to get you to do.
I love that. That is maybe my favorite answer of all time. And not because you reference back something that I tell my athletes all the time. I say, I promise you, everything I put in there has malice aforethought. So if you have any questions, ask me why I put it in there. And if I can't tell you the reason behind it, then you could feel free to ignore it.
Feel free to ignore it. Exactly. Yeah, 100%. If your coach doesn't know why you're doing it, and look at this sport. Look at how this sport has evolved in North America, and how many fallacies of people are operating under. You know, like you need to lift, and you must do it this way, and you must do that, and you know,
dogma.
This is why we've got, you know, so many styles and you know, cults of personality. If you don't know why your coach is telling you to do something other than that's the way we do it, then you know, get the fuck out of there.
This is how my coach taught me. Yeah. Therefore, this is how we do it. Right.
Bingo. And that extends to much more than just, you know, kettlebell.
That's just good life advice. Ask why. Yeah. And if the answers don't make sense, feel free to run. Well, Dave, really appreciate you taking the time, man. This was super fun. I always enjoy catching up with you, man. So I appreciate that we turned on the camera and actually recorded one for once.
Right.
So
yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. Absolutely. Well, listen, Jordan, it's you're one of my favorite people in this community. So I always enjoy spending any time with you and chatting about, you know, anything we got time for. So, hey, thank you so much. And this has been a blast.
Yeah. Appreciate you, man. We'll talk soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Platform Podcast. We'll be back with a new episode soon. Please be sure to leave a rating and review of the Platform Podcast in your app of choice. Support our work by supporting our affiliates. And of course, if you have questions or you want help reaching your goals, reach out to me. Until next time, thanks for listening.